right, welcome back to another edition of the Sunstone Podcast. I'm your host, John Larson, and I'm sitting here next to my compadre, the effervescent, what describes you these days?
Swollen. My allergies are really bad right now.
It has been an allergic season. We've been living in Seattle and Salt Lake for the past like month and a half. Like the rain.
Yeah, I know. I think that means that we need to be stocking up on our food storage because we've been given the sign that when the weather starts to go a little funky, that the end is near.
I was told that too, but I've never been able to find the source of that.
Cleon Skousen.
Is it really Sheriff Skousen or Chief of Police Skousen? I thought it had to do with the White Horse prophecy.
I don't know. That's too weird even for me.
So this year we've been on a tour of fantastic Mormon sites. We've been to Kirtland, right? We've been to Short Creek, right? And now we're here in almost literally the navel of Mormon existence, except the navel is probably Levan. I'm looking at the room. Levan is navel spelled backwards, and it is literally in the middle of the state. But we're just across the mountain from that in Manti, Utah, which is one of the first and early settlements of the Mormon Empire as we came out here to the Great Basin.
This is pioneer country still. I mean, you go throughout town and there's pioneer monuments everywhere. Modern buildings made to look like old pioneer buildings with pioneer inscriptions. This is where a lot of pioneer settlers have a lot of history.
Right. This was one of the early settlements as the Scandinavians came in. Of course, the church started its Scandinavian mission in 1850, and there was a great migration all over the United States. You'll see pockets of Scandinavian communities, and there were a lot of Scandinavians that came into Salt Lake that had converted, and generally they were kind of poor farmers. They weren't as skilled of workers, so they got sent out to the colonies, and they were some of the first ones. In 1850, they opened this area up in the middle of the state, so they started coming down here, and then in 1860, they opened up Logan. They waited a little bit longer because they didn't know if they could actually grow things. It gets colder up there. So in 1860, they started sending Scandinavians. So if you'll see a lot of Johnsons and Larsons and Andersons, then a lot of them come from down here.
And we're also in San Pete County, which is where my people come from and some of your people too.
Yes. Yeah. My dad's family, the Larsons, if you go back to my grandparents, they've been down here for four or five generations. So
it was described in a lot of pioneer journals as San Peach, and then sometimes Sand Pitch. And how I figure that out is in Colorado City, we call it Short Creek or the Crick. We do the little I with it. So I think it was the same thing with San Pete, San Pitch. It was just lazy Utah accent.
And I've read several different accounts of where the name Sand Pitch comes from. Some of them attribute it to a Ute chief's name. Some of them talk about because there was a lot of sand around here. I don't know.
But it was this town is allegedly called Copenhagen because there was so many people from Denmark that came here. But it was originally founded by some British pioneers, English pioneers, and Welsh pioneers. I think the first mayor of the town was Welsh.
Yeah, the first people who founded were the English, and the English had sort of a higher hierarchy, and especially if they had converted, because remember the apostles went on a mission to Britain back in the 1840s. So you had British converts who had been in Nauvoo, and there was a lot of cachet to having known Joseph Smith. If you knew Joseph Smith by the time you came out here, then you were kind of a little bit of a higher order. Now, we're here for a very special occasion. Tonight is the second to last performance of the Manti pageant. And we're here with a group of folks. Let's hear you. To see, we're gonna head over there. We're gonna get our blankets, this is a homecoming for me of sorts. My grandparents, like I said, lived in Ephraim, and their job was they ran the snow cone stand, and they would spend all winter cooking snow cone syrup. I do not eat snow cones to this day because we had great big liter or you know gallon jugs of snow cone syrup at my house all the time. But those two, my grandparents, would hand make all that snow cone syrup, and that's how the wards down here kind of funded all their activities is by running this pageant.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I have a memory here too. And I think we're going to take memories from some of the folks that are with us today of the Manti pageant. But I came as a youth for youth conference and it was really fun. We always knew that we got to stay up extra late. We'd take a bus just like we did. We basically planned this after my youth group. Take a bus, go down to Manti, eat the turkey dinner at the Armory, go sit and watch the pageant and then drive home at, you know, midnight. And that felt a little risque to do with boys and girls youth activity.
Oh, yeah. I guess now that you say that, my ward one time camped out on my grandparents' yard. They all went down there and came afterwards. Now, every summer I would come down to Sampi and we would spend a week or 2 weeks with my grandparents. And so every year I would go to church with these kids. Now, the Manti has a population of about 2,000 people. And Ephraim, its sister city right up the road, has a population of about 3,000. So that's about 5,000 people. The according to the church's website, this thing takes over 1,100 volunteers to run. So if you think about it, 20% of the entire population of this area is involved in running this pageant. And the thing I was telling you is that as the kids, there's a hierarchy of the positions. So you'd start, if you were a little kid, then maybe you could become one of the handcart pioneer families. But what all the teenagers want would be actually the Lamanites, not the Nephites, because the Lamanites got to die, so you could do your dramatic death up on the mountain. So those kids, as they grew up, and then of course the ultimate position would be to be the boy selected to be Joseph Smith.
Well, we haven't seen the pageant yet, and it's been a few years since I've seen it. But can you, John? Do you want to like walk through a brief synopsis of what it's supposed to be in the story that it tells?
It's the story of humanity. It's the story of the Book of Mormon. Now, for those who are unschooled in Mormon folklore, Manti has a special place as far as temples go, because it is said that when Brigham Young dedicated the spot, he walked over to the southwest cornerstone and pointed to it, and he said, "This is the very spot that Moroni himself dedicated this temple." So the belief is that Moroni, during the period when he was walking around with no place to lay his head or whatever, that he wandered over here to this site and dedicated it. And that, especially for locals, gives a great point of pride. You'd get in a fight if you told them that was legend or anything.
Yeah, and because it is considered legend, historian Artis Partial has sort of debunked this on her blog. She can't trace it back to Brigham Young. She can trace it back to, I think, in the 1880s when it was published in a church magazine as a story for the first time. But that doesn't matter, because people here, it's become a huge legacy, a huge part of their story. I mean, it's a very literal history to a lot of people in the town still.
So we have the pioneers and the epic battles from the Book of Mormon. And, so it's just the whole arc of sort of Mormon folklore, theology, and that sacred history is what we're going to see told grand scale.
And they do it on the hill. So the Manti Temple, for those who've never seen it, is on a hill. It's literally on a hill. Do you want to talk about the hill for a minute?
Well, it was a quarry, and when they first came down here in 1850, when the saints first came here, there's not a lot of timber available in the valley, so they built dugouts. If you read Little House on the Prairie, and there was still some folklore that got passed down to me and the family. They mostly complain about they leaked terribly. The hill here, because it was kind of rocky, was notorious for being full of rattlesnakes. So they even talk about rattlesnakes getting into their dugouts. So they dug out their houses up on the hill, and that's where they lived. It must have been a miserable way to live. So they were either in the dugouts, or they would flip their wagons over, and they would turn that into a makeshift shelter to winter.
And so that's where they do the pageant now, up on this hill, and you can try out for it, like you said. It's a huge, huge production, and over the years, it's gotten even better and refined. It's really produced well, actually, from what I understand. It's been years since I've seen it.
Right. Well, here's a bit of trivia for you. Who is the voice of Mormon? Does anybody know? It's Melvin Ballard, who is a member of the Quorum of the Twelve, who is... what's his name? The one that's currently in the Ballard
Elder.
Elder. Which Ballard is in the used car salesman? M. Russell. M. Russell is rumored to have been inactive for a while, before he got called to be a stake president, a mission president. But he was Melvin's son, and Melvin was involved in this, and it's his voice. So you're hearing a voice from the dust of a former apostle of God when the
It might Mormon as well talks. Be Mormon or Moroni.
So this pageant started in 1967. I want to give a little background. I'm always talking about the golden age of the church. And one thing that's great about the church, if you read the history of it, is almost everything that used to be in the church that you like came locally. The church really didn't develop top down. So there were a lot of cultural elements, things like the Sunday school, the Boy Scout program, the young women's programs. These were oftentimes started locally by stakes, and then the church would pick that up and take that on. And this was one of those things. During the 60s, the church was very, very cultural. Matter of fact, one of the first buildings built in Salt Lake City in 52, I think, was the old Utah Theater. Brigham Young was a big fan of the theater, and really they put a lot of time and treasure into the arts, and they liked to dance. Now, the boys didn't dance with the girls at that time. The boys danced with the boys, and the girls were left home to raise the children.
Well, even Brigham Young's son is the famous Brigham Mormon. Brigham, I'm forgetting it now. What? Brigham Morris Young, right? And he was Madame Petrini. Have you guys heard of Madame Petrini before? Famous operetta. Brigham's son would dress as Madame Petrini. That was his stage character, and he had the most beautiful falsetto voice, they said, and it was actually very well respected as an opera star.
So post-war, your 50s and 60s, Mormon culture starts kind of ramping up. There's a lot of prosperity. Stakes oftentimes have money, so in that time, you would see them buying campgrounds. There's a lot of property owned up in the hills, and the church did a lot of things. Like they launched a church-wide basketball tournament, and so the stakes, they were still kind of doing this when I was young, but the stakes have a basketball tournament, then you could go to area, and if you won area, they would do it in the old Deseret Gym, which is where the conference center stands right now. And so they do church-wide basketball tournaments. They also did this like dance festival that happened at BYU every year, where all these stakes would learn to do these big choreographed dances, and they'd all come together and do this great big pageantry show. So it was a time when Mormon culture really embraced recreation, arts, theater, and that's why when you go into the churches, they still all have like a theater seating. You know, they have a stage, and if you go into old churches, ones built before say 75 or 80, they'll have the full background to have props and all that kind of stuff. So it really was a time when the church was embracing those sort of cultural expressions.
So I'm researching the life and history of Juanita Brooks right now, and she talks a lot about this culture growing up in Bunkerville, Nevada. So her mom was a singer, and their entire world, their Mormon world, revolved around her mom would practice songs for months, and then they would sing it at testimony meeting as part of their testimony. And they would practice for these church productions for months and months and months. It was a big deal. It was really the sort of cultural nexus of their lives for a lot of people when they didn't have to go to Salt Lake or they were trapped in these tiny little towns. And out of that comes a generation of people that would have grown up in the 60s. And now we have this confluence of this history of putting on plays and shows in your own ward and the Saturday's Warrior sort of mentality.
Right. So these sort of pageants happened. The big ones, there's one that's still happening at Mesa, the Mesa Temple. I believe it happens at Easter. And that one's coming to an end next year in 2020. This year is the last for the Manti pageant and for the Cumorah pageant. And so that's why we're here. It's the end of an era. So, Lindsay, why are they ending it?
So that's a good question that we're going to speculate on today. The LDS Church recently came out with some direction under the new prophet, President Nelson. They have said basically we're discouraging pageants now. And that sounds like kind of maybe a small thing to some people, but there are a lot of pageants. We're just counting up the pageants that we know of. Can you name off some of them?
Well, we were talking before, there's the Man Who Knew, which is the one up in... about Martin Harris up in Logan. There's the three big ones, this one in Mesa and Manti. We were just talking about one that's over across the hill, over, it was in Orangeville. Where did we say it was? Castledale. I didn't know about that one. Now, to understand this, kind of like why people don't know, the church didn't take over ownership of common property until into the 70s. And there's still a lot of stakes in Utah that independently own their own building and their own property. So it was really common for stakes to function very independently and just put on their own production. When I was a kid, my stake put on a production of Camelot. You would never hear that happening today. But, you know, they had the money and they bought the sets and they rehearsed. And so
I grew up, my grandfather wrote a very prolific in his area play called Joseph, and it was about Joseph Smith. And I remember as a little girl, I never saw the play, but they would sit around at family parties and tear up and cry thinking about this play and tell me about how Lynn Chatterton in the Ward was the perfect Joseph Smith, and he carried his aura and his presence. It was a really important part of their lives.
Well, and things like Star Child and Saturday's Warrior, My Turn on Earth, these often would start and they would locally tour. Matter of fact, the Osmonds started that way, touring from stake center to stake center to stake center, performing that way. So at the time, doing something like this was really common. Now, we're talking about why the church wants to discontinue. You're showing me.
So I have the statement that the church has put out on their website. It says, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has announced officially which pageants will continue following the church's October 27, 2018 statement that, quote, the goal of every activity in the church should be to increase faith in the Lord Jesus Christ and to share his gospel message throughout the world, end quote. According to Newsroom, Church's Newsroom, conversations on how to modify or end pageant productions took place in October 2018, and three of the seven productions will continue. The pageants that will continue are as follows. The Nauvoo pageant with support from church headquarters. The Mesa pageant will be held under area leadership in 2021 after the renovation of the Mesa Arizona Temple. So it sounds like they're just going to pause it.
Okay.
And then the British pageant under area leadership to be held every 4 years. The next production will be in 2021. The pageants to end include the Hill-Cumorah pageant to end in 2020 after its summer production, the Manti pageant to end following its 2019 performance, which is now, the Castle Valley pageant and the Clarkston pageant.
You look pretty righteous, so I'm not sure you're going to understand this simile, but most podcasts are like beer. You have to drink a lot to get that buzz. The Sunstone Magazine podcast, on the other hand, is like whiskey. Small glass, big buzz. That's because our podcast isn't about interviews, conversation, or witty banter. Rather, it presents audible quality recordings of Sunstone's best articles, essays, fiction, and poetry. Do you want to hear what the best LDS minds have to say when they say it perfectly? Then this podcast is for you. Listen to some of our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone, and then join us for a weekly shot of the best of Mormon thought and experience. And yes, you'll be able to drive home safely afterward and get a temple recommend if you want.
Now, this isn't the first time the church has announced they're closing this thing down. The first time they did is in 1991. Actually, I was doing a little research, and President Hinckley intervened after the announcement. So I imagine that the production itself is a big deal. And you look at the history, like when I was reading, this was a local production, and the first year they didn't allow anybody on the temple grounds except the performers. So when we go there, there'll be a fence. So everyone was sitting out in the street, and the fairgrounds are right across the street from the temple. So they hauled the bleachers over and dropped them on the sidewalk, and everybody sat there because the church said, no way, you can't get on the temple grounds. And then they've allowed people to come in. It's kind of evolved over time until it's enormous production now.
It's an enormous production. It's a tradition for a lot of people to make a pilgrimage here. I've talked to some of the people that are here with our group today. Some did it as a family thing. Some did it as a youth thing. I did it as a youth thing. We never went with a family, but it's also interesting because it brings in a lot of different Mormon traditions. And so there's a lot of fundamentalists in Manti already. They're part of this, and some of them own some of the businesses that people frequent when they come down to Manti. And do you want to talk about the protesters?
I want to talk about you always using the word fundamentalist, because I see all Mormons as fundamentalists from my perspective.
It's a lazy label.
Okay, so we're talking about the ones who aren't Brighamite. All right. So does anybody have any, before I start slagging on this thing, does anybody have any positive memories or memories at all of the pageant that they want to share? You can say your
name. Jake. So I would do security, parking, all that when I grew up. And there was always hot girls that would come.
Well, the question is, were people hooking up, and where was that happening? Oh, okay. How many here are, this is the first time they're going to see the pageant? So about 80% just raised their hand for the first time. That's kind of odd to me, because it was such a big, but again, you and I are both connected down to this area. Maybe people who weren't connected never really thought about it very much.
Maybe. You guys are in for a treat tonight then. Be prepared. It's like, the thing that I like about this pageant is it's got a Disney-esque quality to it, which I think all of 1970s Mormonism really is influenced by the same sort of things that Walt Disney was doing at the same time. And that's why I think I could write a whole thesis on Mormonism and Disney and why they're compatible and why Disney is the plan of happiness. But that's for a different time. But the Manti pageant is very Disney-esque. Like, the only thing that's missing is like the water lights and, you know, fireworks or something.
Okay, so let's talk about the reason I think the pageant is closing down. It's terribly racist, for one thing, and it's really American exceptionalism writ large. So Mormonism, in my opinion, humble opinion, has taken and doctrinally solidified the idea that America is a more important country than every other country, and white people are at the top of the food chain. It's literally in the Book of Mormon. Literally says that brown people are brown so that white people won't find them attractive. It's right there in the book. And it says that when brown people get righteous, they turn white. And it was a teaching of the church until 1978. And I'll tell you, I was 5 in 1978, and that teaching continued for many years from my own personal experience, that, you know, white people were superior to brown people. And this pageant has that as its fundamental, it's in there. All this stuff about America being a special place and white people being a special people is baked right into this pageant.
I want to say something, and then you can go on with the reason why you think that it is. But another thing that's important about this pageant to remember is it really romanticizes the idea of the American Indian. And I mean to say that as a stereotype, but that makes sense considering the church history. So there are a lot of scholarly writings about early Mormonism and Joseph Smith, quote, playing Indian. So at the time when Joseph Smith would have written or translated the Book of Mormon, a lot of people on the edges of the frontier were doing what we call playing Indian. If you were a person of color, you could literally pretend to be an Indian and go from town to town and become a performer. And there are some people that engage with Mormonism that way. And which I think his name is Pete. Do you remember? There's a book about it. There's a book about an Indian that Joseph Smith converted, who was actually, we think, an African-American man, who was William McCary. Is that right? Does that sound right? And so he was playing Indian, but there's a whole story of like Sidney Rigdon went and converted a bunch of people in Kirtland. Then the elders left and the whole congregation got in trouble for performing battles from the Book of Mormon, including scalpings and everything that they thought the Indians did. Americans just had a fascination with that. Well, it happened again in the 70s with Kimball. Kimball became really obsessed with the idea of taking on this Lamanite mission. And we see that, I think, reflected in a lot of these pageants. He gets excited about the idea that we can finally convert the Lamanites. And you see that in this pageant completely.
Yeah, for sure. And this is an American tradition. If you think about the Boston Tea Party, that they dressed up as Indians, right? And during a lot of the conflicts and wars, when there were raids, people would oftentimes dress up as Indians. Of course, we know from Mountain Meadows that it's not exactly clear how many of the natives were there, and versus if they were just folks dressing up. So there's a long tradition of sort of pretending to be Indians in the United States in order to usually make mischief.
Yeah, and I think that was a really compelling idea when we talk about the Saturday's Warrior generation, just this idea that there was, you know, we get really excited about some of the mystical elements of Mormonism that disappear right after they start to have this resurgence in the 70s. And a lot of it came through art. And I think that one of my reasons why I think that the church is getting rid of this is art became the main mechanism in the 70s, in my opinion, to teach people the doctrine, right? I mean, people like me and like so many here grew up with Saturday's Warrior or My Turn on Earth, and that was like doctrine to us, even though it wasn't officially put out by the church. And so it's hard to control the message when you have artists interpreting doctrine in a way that maybe is or is not consistent with the institutional narrative. Yeah, it was William McCary who was, or Warner McCary. He was a performer and a musician and claimed to be a prophet. He actually took on plural wives at one point. Joseph Smith had to shut that down because he got a little too excited about the doctrine. But he was someone who played Indian. And I think that I look at Mormonism, I'm not a literal believer in the Book of Mormon, so I believe that it was Joseph Smith's attempt at playing Indian.
All right, so let's go back and talk about Manti and why this place is important and important to Mormon history. The Saints came into the Valley in 1847, as we all know from the days of 47, and those first couple of years were really difficult. They were basically starving to death. And you read the journals, every kind of weed you see on the side of the freeway, they were trying to eat because there wasn't a lot. And they kind of sent too many people over in 48, and they kind of overwhelmed the resources. And at that time, they were all kind of hunkered down where Pioneer Park is right now, where they built the fort. So in the early years, they lived inside that fort, and then some people would kind of go out. They'd follow the Joseph Smith pattern of a city, so the pastures were all sort of on the outside. So you might go sleep out in the pasture with the sheep or whatever for a while, and then come back into the fort, especially in the winter. So migration kind of held, and then the gold was discovered on the West Coast. So there started to be a huge amount of immigration starting particularly in 1850. And when they started coming through the Salt Lake Valley, by the time they got to Salt Lake, they were ready to sell their stoves and there's all this talk of getting furniture and like rocking chairs and couches from these people who just want to lighten up to get to the coast as fast as they could. So that brought an infusion of capital. So the church needed a few years to get their feet underneath them. Now, to the north was Peter Skeen Ogden and Fort Buenaventura. So Ogden was controlled by Gentiles and always has been. And to the south were the Ute Indians, who had a winter camp that they kept in Utah Valley. You had the lake, and there's a lot of good rivers and game and fish. So they were there. There were some, as Lindsay points out, there were some settlements kind of early in Utah County. We were talking about this earlier, but they didn't really take as much hold because the Indians still kind of controlled that territory. But Chief,
let me say something about please. That. So you have to understand Manti and the history of Manti. You have to understand the history of the Walker War. We already sort of talked about it on the bus, so sorry if you guys are getting a repeat. But basically, when the Mormons got here, they were in Mexican territory. They had left the United States, and the slave trade, the Indian slave trade, was thriving. The leaders of the slave trade were the Utes. They would. There's a long history of centuries of selling slaves, but at this point, local bands of Utes were selling Paiutes, basically. Paiute children were the highest valued in the slave trade. So the Mormons arrive here, and as they arrive here, the territorial legislature decides to get rid of Mexico, basically, and that puts an end, theoretically, to the slave trade. Chief Walker is really upset about it. That's how they had thrived and survived for so long, selling children to people going in, you know, Spanish conquistadors looking for mines. And they expected to do that with Mormons. And Brigham Young said, no, we're not going to do that. So the Indians, the local Ute bands, get really, really upset because that is how they had survived for so long. And so some conflicts start happening in Manti.
Right. But Chief Walker, he was really, I don't know his full history. I know that he spoke some Pidgin English, and he made contact with Brigham Young fairly early. And Walker really was impressed with the white settlers' ability to do farming and animal husbandry. And so he allowed them to come down into this territory here in Manti, where they camped by the river, as part of the agreement that the Mormons would teach them how to do agriculture.
But hold on, let me put a little asterisk to that. Walker would often give the Mormons permission to settle and to take over the property of local bands that Walker wasn't always in charge of, but he was in charge of because he ran by like an iron fist. So if Walker came and said, your band is going to do this, they had to do it or die.
Right. And we talk about, you know, that when we talk about the Utes, they were they were a class of people run by warlords, really, and they had a common language and a common culture, but the bands were fairly independent, and oftentimes they would fight amongst themselves. So, and they would raid one another. So we sometimes talk about Walker and the Utes as if he was commanding this big army of 20,000. It wasn't that way. But this landscape, Utah was a rough place. I mean, it was a hard tack place to make a living, to live, and because of that, I think it turned the people who lived here. And this is true for all over the West, into pretty rough people. So the Indians were, who were here, the Utes and the Paiutes and the Shoshone and the Bannock and the Blackfeet, they were a violent group, even amongst themselves. So we don't want to, because in American history, we kind of go from vilifying the Indians to turning them into these noble savages. And we need to be realistic that the culture that was here among the Indians was violent, and the slave trade was part of that.
Yeah, we're talking about intergenerational trauma here. And one of the things that I think justified the Mormon treatment of Native Americans, especially the Paiutes, were if you look through any pioneer journal, they will talk about how degraded, right? That's the word that they would use, the Paiutes are. And those ideas still persist in cultural Mormonism today. A lot of Mormons see Mormons as these benevolent helpers of these Native American peoples whose land that they colonize, even though they don't recognize that we brought with us disease. We killed off, I mean, thousands of Native American peoples with disease alone. And we got them really dependent on us because we took our cattle, ate all their crops, and ruined all of their systems, took their water away. Well, by the time the Paiutes were really made up of refugees from the slave trade. They were banded together, and the slave trade was a torturous place. So when we talk about these dirty, dishonest Native Indians in the journals of our ancestors, that's how they looked at them, without an understanding that they had literally been displaced for centuries without a culture, without a cohesive lineage. So how are they supposed to be anything other than, you know, surviving in a very brutal frontier world?
Well, and simply there was a different approach. They were semi-nomadic. They would oftentimes have settlements for years, but you know, as if you stayed in any one place too long, garbage would pile up and human waste would pile up, and you'd have hygiene problems with the horses. So you needed to move quite regularly. So this happened all through America. Is the settlers would come in. You know, there would be trading. There would be it would seem all nice, and then the white folks would move in and set up permanent establishments. And I think there was this conflict of what it meant to share the land that I think oftentimes there wasn't the same sense of ownership, because there couldn't be if you were semi-nomadic people. So I don't necessarily think they knew what they were trading away. And, you know, like Lindsay just hinted at, one of Brigham Young's strategy to keep actually other white settlements from taking over was to control all of the water, any major spring. Well, like Lindsay's implying, once they did that, they dropped a fort on top of every spring from, you know, Canada down to Mexico. Well, if you're the native people, that's one of your sources of water. That's one of your sources to be able to water your crops. And, you know, if you're planting whatever it is here, and then you head up in the hills for the summer to hunt game and come back to harvest, well, your harvest isn't there anymore. So you had a real conflict of lifestyle. You know, one of the classic ones is horse trading. So the Utes, there were by this time the Spanish horses had been loose, so they would trap wild horses and then they'd sell them to white settlements. And of course the slave trade, which natives usually would be trapped, enslaved up here and trafficked down into Mexico, where they would be sold. So it was not only just, you know, it was a harsh, harsh environment, because you'd be forced marched 1,000 miles through the desert. But you know, the settlers would come in and they would trade with the Indians and everything was fine. And then the Indians would come down and raid and take horses. And what the Indians would expect is, well, you'll come and raid and take horses from us. But what the whites would do is say is horse theft was a capital offense in the 19th century. So the whites would go roll into the camp and then kill everybody. And so there's this constant cultural conflict of these two people all through America unable to live together.
So in the winter of 1864 and 1865 was really, really brutal, especially for any indigenous tribes that were living in San Pete. At this point, there was a smallpox epidemic that ravaged through, killing hundreds of people, and it started to make the bands that were living there resentful. And they thought about, you know, blaming this on white encroachment. And so there were a lot of tense little skirmishes, you know, cattle being stolen, people being hurt, things like that. And it really bubbles over in Manta, Utah. This is where it happens with the Walker War. They bring some local Ute leaders together and local Mormons, and one Mormon gets really drunk and attacks a chief, embarrasses him in front of his tribe, and it starts like a big conflict here that finally got settled later on with Wakara. But for a long time, it really, I think, established in this area Mormon cohesion, Mormon loyalty. They had three forts at some point. And what would happen is you would come and settle, and you would settle your cabin or your homestead or whatever, but you would have to often abandon it whenever there was threats of violence. And so Mormons came here and they settled, and they sort of became a cohesive group in Manti. And that really, I think, started a sort of feverish radical extremism in southern Utah, because it was separate. They didn't enjoy the protections of Salt Lake. So down here, they were kind of on their own, fighting a lot of local bands that had been driven out of Salt Lake.
Well, if you think about it, what would oftentimes happen, and my great-grandfather, who I had the pleasure to meet, he died at 102, and he self-identifies an Indian killer. Take that for what it's worth. But, you know, he would tell stories. They'd have the boys sit on certain knolls to watch the canyons. And these raids and fights that happened in San Pete County continued into the 20th century. There were still skirmishes going back and forth between folks. And they would send the boys up, and they would be on top of a hill. And then they would send a signal, usually firing a gun or setting off dynamite or something. And then if you were in the valley, everybody just ran to the fort because you knew a raid was coming. That sort of thing would really unite you together as a people and install hatred and fear of the other.
Well, and I'm going to read this because this comes from, I always try to find indigenous histories too, not just Mormon histories, because it's obviously told differently. They claim that these are some descendants of Black Hawk. They claim that Mormons were coming. They had increased population in the 7 years since they had been here. Sorry, from 1847 to 1865, had increased population by 50,000. And meanwhile, about 40,000 Native Americans were dying of disease. 40,000 is a lot. They also decimated their crops, which were their source of food, plowed their vital grasslands, destroyed native plants, and did a lot of logging. And the Black Hawk War was like 150 deadly incidents that happened over the course of 7 years. And a lot of it really played out here in Manti, which is interesting because Manti becomes really a stronghold of the church. Like we said, let's get to the temple, talk about how the temple got here. That would be announced by Brigham Young right before his death. He would dedicate the land for the temple. So by the time the settlers had arrived in the valley to the 1870s, Manti really becomes a hub. San Pete County was a hub for really a lot of the European Mormons.
Yeah, so Brigham Young lost control of Salt Lake City really early, like 1852 early. Because once the 49ers started coming through, merchants started coming, businesses were set up. There was a strong foothold of Jewish-owned businesses by the mid-1860s. And Brigham was constantly trying to wrestle for control of the city. Of course, never had control of Ogden. Still doesn't. But this area, these colonies that were set up, the ones like Manti and St. George, they were successful from a church model because they were early adopters. By the time the Scandinavians came over, they were often very poor, so they were very reliant on the church. So when you came down here, if crops didn't feed everyone, then Salt Lake would send down food to keep the people from starving. So they became very beholden to kind of the United Order and those elements. And those things were rolled out very early down here in Manti and in St. George in that area as sort of an early test bed. They never really tried to do the United Order in Salt Lake. It was in 68, I think, when Brigham instituted ZCMI and sort of said it was an excommunicatable offense to buy anything from a Gentile. But that was later. So the folks down here were really dependent and used to having strong church influence. And we talk about the church, we impose a modern mindset of thinking that separate from the government. There was no difference. The bishops were the mayors. The bishops controlled all of the food production. They could assign, they could take your property away and give it to somebody else. That sort of stuff didn't happen as often as we kind of make it sound, because we love to tell the dirty stories. But they were really close to the church. So this became a stronghold for the church. And when they decided to build multiple temples, it was St. George, Logan, and Manti that were the first ones sort of announced.
Yeah, and we talked about on the bus a man, the Bishop of Manti, Warren Snow. He was known as pretty much a zealot. He would take the violent rhetoric. He was part of the Nauvoo Legion. He was in the Walker War. He was a general in the Walker War. And by the time he was stake president and bishop and then not stake president, Bishop of Manti, he really ruled things with an iron fist. In fact, there's some lore based on Anne Gorge, who was a wife of John D. Lee. She claims that that she was basically married. Her narrative is a little bit unreliable. She's has a trauma narrative that's inconsistent, but she claims that she was sold basically to John D. Lee because her parents were concerned about the abuse and the castrations and the secret workings of the Danites, and they were scared. So they gifted her at 17 years old to John D. Lee as a plural wife. So everybody here, whether the fear was warranted or not, there was a fear that you didn't step out of line, or someone like Warren Snow would come and make sure that you got back in line.
So this temple, I think, was announced in 75. Is that right? And it was built sometime in the 1870s. I think it was the fifth temple to be completed, and that counts Kirtland and Nauvoo, and then I guess it was St. George first, Logan, and then this one. So they're all completed before Salt Lake. Now, on the northwest corner of Temple Square, sort of where the visitor center is, where the Christus is, that's where the endowment house was. And the endowment house was dedicated to doing temple work. As a matter of fact, they would do the moving from room to room in the endowment house, and the murals from the creation room and that. They didn't have the four like they do in these temples. Now, the modern temple ceremony, as we know, didn't exist in Kirtland at all. The closest thing they had was kind of a sort of a proto washing and anointing ceremony. In Nauvoo, they started developing, and they did it in the top floor, but they would move things in. So they had these, one of my favorites, they had like a tree that was on in a planter on wheels that they would rode. So when they were in the creation myth in Nauvoo, they would roll that in. So when they built the endowment house in the 1860s, it really was like a temple and started taking on the form of the modern temples. These old temples are really built based still on the Kirtland model, and they're just really expanded. They if you look at Kirtland to Nauvoo to St. George, they're basically the same temple that starts getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And what it does is they start figuring out, well, if we make it this much bigger, we can put rooms on the side. And then we can do these things. So this temple, in Manti, matches the old model. And for those who are uninitiated in the temple follows an ancient tradition of these sort of passion plays. And it was really common in the Middle Ages, especially the early Middle Ages, to do these sort of things. Remember, people had no access to books. Most people were illiterate. So oftentimes, like at Easter, there would be an Easter passion play, and they would play out the roles of the scriptures. They would model those things. So having a play where Adam shows up and talks to Eve, this is not something the Mormons invented, and I say that in endearing that it was borrowed, and it was borrowed mostly through the Freemasons, who had continued that tradition as a lot of orders of that magnitude had. So the Kirtland Temple or the Nauvoo Temple ceremony came very based on that, and that exists in this temple today. So you do have the Aaronic priesthood room and the Melchizedek priesthood room on two floors. I think they have them both. And it's been so long since I've been in the Manti Temple. And then you move. So you start in the creation room, and then you move to the lone and dreary world, and then you move to the terrestrial room, which in the old style you would stay there to go to the you'd go to the celestial, then the terrestrial, and then you'd move to the celestial room. They also had a baptismal font in this temple. That was not part of Kirtland or Nauvoo, and they would have the marriage sealing rooms, and then they'd have the Holy of Holies. All the early temples have one. Ogden and Provo do not. The Holy of Holies was used to do the second anointing, and there's a lot of misinformation out there, but that's what the Holy of Holies was for. The second anointing is a two-part ceremony, one that happens in the temple and one that happens at home. So this temple does actually have one.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Anson Park, Executive Director of the Sunstone Education Foundation. I want to invite you to our weekly Sunstone Firesides. Do you remember those? Firesides that they used to have dating all the way back to the 1930s, when the LDS Church would hold monthly meetings to discuss really important gospel topics. Those meetings became known endearingly as Firesides. In January of 2019, Sunstone launched a new podcast that incorporates a nod to these firesides. Featuring a weekly evening podcast, it will display a range of hosts, all women, as they chat with diverse guests from across the Mormon spectrum. The hosts are all female-identifying that represent a broad perspective in Mormonism. These podcasts will be released every Thursday evening, so you can have that fireside feel brought right into your living room. So grab a cup of cocoa or coffee, since at Sunstone there is more than one way to Mormon. Snuggle up under a blanket and listen to incredible interviews by and from incredible people. You can support women and their work in Mormon studies, which is desperately needed, by donating at sunstone.org or becoming a monthly subscriber. Go to sunstone.org and click on the podcast tab for more info. We hope you enjoy it as much as we do. If you were on the bus, you already heard this, but William Folsom was the architect for this temple. He was first counselor to Truman Angel, who designed the Salt Lake Temple. Folsom also designed the Provo Tabernacle and the Tabernacle in Salt Lake City, ZCMI, and a few county buildings and things like that. So he liked the French Renaissance Gothic Revival style, and the Manti Temple is in that style. And it's gone through a lot of renovations, and just like the pageants are now dead, the church has announced that all the pioneer temples are being renovated. So all of these live passion plays, as you say, it's going to change. It's changing right now. And I think that that's interesting, because really these pageants are passion plays as well. And I think they derive a lot from not just Victorian frontier culture at the time, but also the fact, I mean, that's where the temple culture in my mind can be placed to, but also that they were doing it in the temple. These live plays weren't seen as ridiculous or silly. They were sacred.
Absolutely. My grandma told me a story, because you had to get married in the temple, right? But oftentimes you might live down in, I don't know, Cokerville or wherever, or one of these small little towns, and you had to get to this temple, and you'd have to take a buggy ride or a wagon. But oftentimes there wasn't enough people free to chaperone the young couple as they were taking their wagon from Orangeville over to the Manti Temple. So she was telling about this network of bed and breakfasts or whatever at the time, where they would try to keep them the young saints out of each other's pants until they got to the temple. And then there's always been a cottage industry in Manti of where you would come and then you'd stay in your honeymoon suite. So everything around here is a honeymoon suite.
That's one way to look at it. Yeah, we don't talk a lot about the endowment house, but because before the temples were built, you know, Brigham Young dies the same year that he dedicates St. George Temple, or that it finishes 1877. This one didn't get finished till 1888. And so Brigham Young would have never seen the completion of really anything. But what is interesting about this town in Manti, before we get into the pageant, is there's a lot of fundamentalist presence here. So Jim Harmston's The True and Living Church, this was their headquarters. Of course, Jim has passed away. But the town is still a lot of property. The Red Brick store in town is owned by the TLC group. There's a lot of polygamous fundamentalist groups that still kind of come here for this. We have some here today, and there are people that live here. And the Manti Temple is famous for what, John? With regard to fundamentalists.
Well, that they sneak in here and get married all the time. And by the way, that's not just a fundamentalist thing. I have met folks in my life who would travel from Ogden or whatever down to this temple because they would still do the live endowment ceremony. So there's still this kind of attitude in the church that that is a more pure form, and that they're very dismissive of the film. But because this area, matter of fact, it's one of the few places in Utah, in Manti, where you can still find old pioneer buildings that still have Holiness to the Lord or the all-seeing eye. I was reading a history after Brigham Young instituted ZCMI and in 68 and forbade Mormons from buying anything from anybody who wasn't a Mormon, they start putting this eye up above every building. And the Mormon interpretation was, oh, that was to remind everybody to be honest. My interpretation is that's saying, we're watching you and you guys better behave because we know what you're doing. And they did. There's many noted excommunications from 68 from just buying material from a Gentile, but the point is they're still on buildings in this town, and that's very rare in Utah. Most of the buildings that have the old Holiness to the Lord or the eyes have been removed. Now the Harmston group, when they came down in it was the early 90s, it was like 94, I think. They started putting it back on buildings. So you'll see it around here. Some of them are old, and some of them are from the True and Living Church, the Harmston group.
So, do you want to start talking about the history of the Manti pageant?
Well, so we started in 67, and it was just sort of this local production, and then it keeps rolling and rolling and rolling.
Yeah, so the first one was said, it's under the stake president Vernon Coons, I believe it was, and they did a pageant. They had planned it for July 23rd, right before Pioneer Day, to be done on this hill, and there was about 2,000 people that attended the first one, which I think is pretty good for your first production ever.
Well, one of the things I like, it's been 30 years since I've been to it, but they were still singing some of the old pioneer hymns. I think this is probably pretty well known by now, but the church can't keep their hands off of anything. So a lot of the hymns have been altered repeatedly over the time. And my mother told me, so this is Mama Larson, that the hymn they used to sing in the temple ceremony, but in the 1960s is when they ended that the devil would talk to the audience, and then the devil would have a preacher come out, and the preacher and the devil together would lead the audience in basically a Protestant hymn. And my mom told me that the hymn that they were singing in the pageant, I'm getting at least one head nod, was that hymn from there's a scene in the old pageant where there's a preacher that comes in and he leads the people. It's Joseph Smith, you know, getting confused by all the religions. But the hymn was the temple hymn. Now, I have looked and looked. I have found the words to the hymn, but I am unsure what the original tune was. And at the time, you know, you can still see it in the old, if you get the 83 hymn book, you know, they'll tell you the meter and the name of the song up front. And it was still common up until the Green Hymn Book came out to sing the hymns with different songs. So there's some old preservation of old pioneer folklore that got embedded into this pageant.
Now I have some of the information that you asked for. So you asked how some of it's changed. One of the things is the location has actually changed. The original place was just west of the temple grounds on the San Pete County Fairgrounds. And I'm just going to give you some fun facts. If you consider them fun, is up to you. So it was moved to its current location in 1968. So it only went 1 year at that place. And the original story was written by Grace Johnson. It was a woman that wrote the script. And it only has six directors. They have a 25 to 35 piece orchestra that would accompany the early days. And now they have a soundtrack. Grace Johnson's story was adapted to true pageant form in 1970 by Mackenzie Rue, who directed the pageant from 1970 to 1989. I guess the soundtrack was produced that same year in 1970 by Bonneville International, so the church actually helped produce the soundtrack. And much of their original recording is still in use today, so we're still using a lot of the original recording, the one that has Melvin Ballard's voice as the prophet Mormon. And we do know that Elder Ballard, who happened to be the nephew of Mackenzie Rue, who took and directed it, donated props to the pageant himself. For the first two decades, the entire cost of production was done by local donations. It was just crowdsourced. And then in 1968, they didn't allow vehicles on the temple property. So the scenery had to all be carried over by hand over the fence by volunteers. And seating outside was outside of the temple grounds. They didn't want people on the temple grounds, but now they do. And they would used to use old hay bales and stuff to sit on. Over 4.5 million visitors have said to watch the pageant in its 50-year history. About 100,000 people come to it annually. Most of the spotlights used for the first decades were homemade with gallon can spray painted black and then wired with light globes. And the town was very, very proud of this. They had made all of the sets and the costumes by local seamstresses, have been sewed by locals in the town. And so everyone took part in this. This is a big part of the town. Do you want to go over any of the numbers? Like there's 14,000 chairs.
Yes, there are 14,000 chairs, which they say they can set up in 3 hours. So I don't doubt it. That's a Mormon superpower. It's just a fascinating production to watch. I think it's an average of 14,000 people what's the number that the church gives? You're looking at the church's official propaganda website.
No, I'm not. I'm just looking at the Manti Pageant's official propaganda website,
which is the church.
And they say that the cast has anywhere from 1,500 to 2,000 cast and volunteers at any given time. The highest amount of cast was in 2016. Where they had just the cast alone was 1,100 members, not including all their volunteers. About 80% of the cast is under 18 years old. So it's mostly kids doing this. And here's a fun fact. The music for the Christ in America scene added in 2000, so that's one of the changes, was composed by the prominent Merrill Jensen, prominent LDS musician.
All right. So it's evolved a little bit in the last few years. And when I used to come back in the 80s, it was a pretty peaceful place. Unfortunately, in the last 20 years or so, this has become a kind of a little battleground of mostly evangelical protesters. Now, I think in deference to many of my Christian friends, this does not represent the way most Christians, even those who want to proselyte Mormons, how they approach. But there has been a long history of protest here. I remember a few years ago, there were a whole bunch of women who came down in costume to represent the wives of Joseph Smith. There's been street preachers, and it's been kind of a little weird battleground down here. I don't know what they're trying to accomplish.
Are the Peterson boys here somewhere? No?
The Peterson boys, they sound like cattle rustlers.
No, I mean, they would know because they come and talk. So what I've pointed out before, what a lot of people don't know is the biggest anti-Mormon protesters are former Mormons and usually former Mormon fundamentalists. And so the Peterson boys would have probably met John Singer Jr. down here. I think they argue doctrine with them.
They're sitting on our blankets holding our spot.
That's right. That's right. So John Singer Jr., who served time in prison for the standoff in Marion, Utah, where they used 50 pounds of dynamite to blow up a stake center and killed an FBI guy. They got out of prison and they've become evangelical Christians and they protest at this. They protest very hard. They make YouTube videos, they have YouTube channels trying to turn Mormons to Christianity. And so I think it's interesting that the biggest protesters are ex-Mormon.
Yeah, I've never really understood that mentality of protesting. But I mean, you have such a visceral big symbol of Mormon dominance. And that's why, you know, I started out and threw that shot across the bow saying this thing is racist and culturist. And I think we who grew up in this this religion need to become a little bit more aware of the embedded arrogance in what we're doing and saying. Mormonism has a lot of wonderful features, and there's been a lot of great people, and there still are a lot of great people who believe, but there is some heavy duty stuff in there. I grew up being told you are the chosen generation. I was told I was the last generation. And then the 80-year-olds told me they were the last generation, and then their grandparents told them they were the last generation. But nevertheless, we really are the last generation. And we grew up thinking that we were God's special people. I mean, I want you to sit with that for a second. You know, think about all the people on this planet, all the Christians on this planet, all the people in America, and we still raise kids to believe you are the ones that God cares about. You're the ones who God will preserve, and you're in a special place, so special that Moroni himself schleps 2,000 miles from, you know, upper state New York across the Badlands to come here to Manti, braving rattlesnakes nonetheless, to bless the hill. And I think this becomes embedded in this sort of culture, and you can see it oftentimes in the things like we talk about, My Turn on Earth, Saturday's Warrior, Star Child. What are some of the others? There's all the missionary ones, like the best 2 years and all this kind of stuff. Where is it this underlying hubris that we don't see? It's blind to us, because Mormons do and can be very humble and very generous, sitting on this throne of superiority, and it sits in these places, which I think attracts the protesters and the detractors.
Well, and I also think that because Mormonism is so high stakes, I guess I bring up the fact that they're mostly ex-Mormon, because I always grew up seeing those protesters thinking they just made me feel more special. I was like, oh, we must be a really big deal that people would come here to try to dissuade us so hard. And now I realize, no, they're just like ex-Mormons. And I've been in this community enough to see the different stages that ex-Mormons go through when they lose everything. It's so stark and painful. Imagine being a Mormon fundamentalist, having such an extreme worldview and having that sort of taken from you. Of course, you would want to be as, zealous outside the church as you would in. And, you know, evangelical Christianity, a lot of people will say, well, why leave Mormonism and join that? And that actually makes sense to me, because a lot of ex-Mormons now have the internet. They can unpack the truth claims of Mormonism with history. But evangelical Christianity offered ex-Mormons a biblical explanation for their pain and dissatisfaction, right? If something didn't fit with you in the church, the Bible would provide an answer for that. So it makes sense to me that people convert to evangelical Christianity and then protest the church, because they lost so much, to feel that you're the most special thing ever and then to lose that's there's a fragility built in that. I think white Mormons are very, very fragile, because we were never allowed to have resilience, right? We were never given resiliency. And so when we fall, we lose everything. And I always say, you know, the only reason that that things have been easier for me than for some other people is because I'm a woman in progressive Mormon spaces, because white Mormon men were promised to be God someday. You guys were like, that was your promise. And when you lose that, you lose salvation. That's a big deal. And so it makes sense to me that people are still angry at Mormonism. We like to sort of say, oh, those protesters and things like that. But why wouldn't we look at them instead of people who lost their entire eternal salvation, and they knew it? And that's how, when I see protesters now who are largely ex-Mormon, that's how I see it. They're just people who have lost that whole worldview. And to me, that's really something to be compassionate about.
I think we've given the history, we've kind of made fun of it a little bit. I do want to, and I know I have a connection here. I do want to kind of honor the people of this area who built this pageant. I don't think this pageant, the way it is and the way it evolved, could have ever been done in Salt Lake, because there's too much of a dependency on orthodoxy. The Scandinavians, if you look at Scandinavia today, it's a very liberal place. And there is very much a live and let live attitude. And if you look at the liberal bastions in the United States, like, I don't know, St. Paul, you know, Minnesota, Wisconsin, very, very Scandinavian, very much they're very religious people. Lutherans and Methodists, they take it very serious, but they're very much a live and let live people. And when I would come down here in the 80s, before kind of the church really kind of tried to take control of everything, I got the sense even as a kid that this was all a little bit tongue in cheek. That this was all fun. It was kids playing with wooden sticks on the hill that everyone got involved in. Everyone was sewing costumes. Everyone was making snow cones. Everyone was cooking turkeys. It was this thing where the community came together. And I think that attitude, for those of you who've had the pleasure of being involved in outside Salt Lake Mormonism, know that they don't take things like premarital sex, coffee, alcohol, all that as seriously as the people in Salt Lake do. So I think there is an element of that. If this had tried to happen in Salt Lake, there have been too many like eggheads worried about orthodoxy and what you can and can't say. And down here in this space, I remember when the Harmston group came down, they a lot of them come out of my home state. So I was interested to talk to my grandfather about them, and they were all kind of like, meh. Like they didn't care. They would make fun of how they were trying to like farm their land, or that they didn't know how to drive their tractors. I remember them saying stuff like that. But I think one of the reasons that the TLC came down here and thrived is because the people here are very tolerant. So I know this is kitschy, and I know it has some elements in it that I frankly find offensive. But I think there's something beautiful about this Mormonism, which I think is a truer form of Mormonism, that's not so much about showy. It's about identity. And I know in my family, it didn't matter that if you were an alcoholic or never set foot in church, you were a Mormon. And the idea that people would leave the church down here is just ridiculous. Why would you leave the church? You were born in the church. The church doesn't make you do anything. And it was very much more of a Catholic attitude. So I think this is a great place to understand traditional Mormonism.
And we talk about how early Mormon saints, it was hard for them to leave Mormonism. It was a scary thing to do, to be an apostate and to leave Mormonism. And we think, that's so crazy. How could that happen? Because it's so inconsistent with Mormonism now, in the sense that it's still hard to leave Mormonism. But if you leave, you're not left with the threat of the Danites following you out in the dead of night, right? I can't help but wonder if that's what generations will think about how our generation lived the word of wisdom. Like, really, they really cared if you drank beer? Because as Jana Reese has done in her new survey, that younger generations of Mormons are not so heterodox or literal in their beliefs. A lot of them are having premarital sex. A lot of them are not following the word of wisdom. And as the church moves away from this heritage-based faith, which is what I was steeped in as a Utah Mormon. That's how I connect with Mormonism, is like white Utah Mormonism heritage. I wonder what it's going to be. I wonder how people are going to connect with Mormonism.
Well, Lindsay, we have to head over to the stake. Is it the stake center or
the armory?
We have to head over to the armory for our turkey dinner. Of course, this is the global center of all turkey growing right here.
San Pete turkey, there's nothing like it. I do know the recipe if anyone wants it. It's just you marinate turkey in 7-Up and soy sauce. That's it.
I was always told by the turkey farmers down here that turkeys were so dumb they could drown in the rain. I don't know if that's true. I'm seeing a couple head nods, but that might just be old folklore.
A way to justify murdering all the turkeys.
I know you can scare them to death. If you really want to, you can go run and shout boo and a couple of them will die. But there's turkeys all over here. Sheep. There were a lot of sheep,
so we're going to go have a turkey dinner, and then we're going to go lay out on the lawn. I actually heard we all got chairs.
Oh,
there's chairs for all of us.
Fantastic.
So we're fancy, and we're going to watch this production, which can go on as long as it wants, and then we're going to take the bus back home, and that's how it's going
to
go.
All right. Well, thanks for tuning in, and we're about to go head up Main Street. If you get a chance to come down to Manti, it's a delightful place to drive through. The people are wonderful down here. This pageant is going away, but go catch one of the others before they're gone. Thanks, Lindsay.
Thanks, John.